If you're anything like me, you're probably always looking for the next great professional in the land business who can help you do what you need to do, like a great real estate agent or a great closing agent, like a title company or accountants or attorneys or private money lenders. We all know it's not that hard to find any real estate agent or any accountant or any title company. But what if you want the best ones who actually understand the land investing business? There's not that many of them out there. And once you find a good one, there is no doubt they are worth their weight in gold. So how are you supposed to find these people? I used to see these posts in our Facebook group all the time, literally every day, from people who were posting these announcements, hoping to find the best professionals that they needed to work with in order to make their business thrive. And I totally understand why people post these things, because where else are you supposed to go? And so I said, you know, why don't I actually try my best to solve the problem? And so that's what I did. I created several different professional directories on retipster.com that are completely submitted and curated by other members of our community. So say, for example, if you're looking for a great investor-friendly title company in Virginia or someplace like that, and you want to find all the title companies that have worked really well for other investors in the community. Well, guess what? We have that now. Go to retipster.com/directory, and you can find all the different directories that we have going right now. And we're actually creating more of these as I speak. So far, we've got one for land specialized real estate agents, accountants who understand the land business, and investor-friendly title companies. So if you ever need help finding these people in whatever market you're working in, this information is here for you. And we've made it extremely easy to sort these people by state and by their specialty. And we include links to their websites. We give their phone numbers, their contact information, everything. And guess what? It's 100% free. That's right. You don't have to pay anything for this stuff. You don't even have to give us your email address. I'm serious. This is unlike anything else you're going to see out on the internet. This is simply an act of love for the land investing community. So if you would find that helpful, or better yet, if you know of a great title company or land specialized real estate agent or accountant, I'd invite you to come and submit that information too. The more this information we can gather, the better. So again, all you have to do is go to retipster.com/directory. Or if you go to the RE Tipster homepage and you go up to the navigation bar and hover over resources, you'll see a menu item called professional directories. If you click on that, it'll take you to the same place. So just wanted to be sure you knew about that so that you can find the people you need. And if you know of some great people, you can submit their information as well. Hey, landlords and property managers, are you struggling to find suitable tenants, manage late rent payments, and handle maintenance requests? Well, I gotta tell you, Tenant Cloud is here to save the day. Tenant Cloud's powerful screening feature conducts full background and credit checks to make sure you find the perfect tenants for your properties so you can avoid those costly and time-consuming evictions. Are you tired of dealing with late payments? Well, Tenant Cloud's got you back there too. It effortlessly manages late payments, and with online payment options, your tenants can pay rent using ACH, PayPal, or credit cards. It's a win-win for everyone. And guess what? There's more. Tenant Cloud's rent reporting feature helps your tenants build their credit scores, fostering better relationships and communication between you and your tenants. So what are you waiting for? Transform your rental business with Tenant Cloud today. You can sign up for a free account and help support RE Tipster through our affiliate link. Just visit retipster.com/Tenant Cloud, and you can make property management a breeze. Hey everybody, how's it going? This is Seth Williams, and you're listening to the RE Tipster Podcast. Today, I'm talking with Ian Horowitz. So Ian is a former professional firefighter turned real estate investor, and he and his partner Dan have spent the past several years pursuing their goal of securing their retirement with a $70 million real estate portfolio. And I wanted to have Ian on the show because I met him at a mastermind meetup this past month in Columbus, Ohio, and he stood out to me as someone who clearly had a lot of good things to say that got people in the room, including me, to think differently about their situations. And given what I learned from him in just a couple of days, I thought this would be a good opportunity to explore his story a bit more. And I'm sure we'll all have some good things to learn from him. So, Ian, welcome to the show. How you doing?
Yeah, Seth, good to see you again. Thanks for having me back, or I guess not having me back, but having me on the show. I love the mastermind environment because that's where I feel like things get resolved. You know, Most of us are probably too scared to actually go to a psychiatrist, but if we get in a room full of real estate investors, we'll figure out the world's problems. But, you know, we used to do that at the firehouse too, so that's why I think I thoroughly enjoy those settings. So I was glad to meet you and excited to jump on your show, and let's do it, man.
Yeah. You are in, is it Baltimore?
Yeah, so our home office is in Baltimore. We're based out of there. My business partner and I, we were actually firemen for the city of Baltimore for almost 15 years. So you ever watch The Wire? It's all true. If you saw the riots that were happening, that's where we worked, the heart of West Baltimore, and that's where we spent a lot of our time.
So you were a full-time firefighter for how many years?
We were a career fireman for the city of Baltimore for roughly 14, 15 years in that time frame. Came in right at the end of the financial crisis, and that's ultimately why we wound up seeking out real estate. But yeah, no, we went there. We were there for 14 years, seen some crazy things, been a part of some crazy things. It's a great career opportunity for our education and our background. However, in the grand scheme of things, it's not a sustainable job if you have a desire and passion to go do more, right? Like, it's great to give back. The core root of the job of going out there and helping people is one of the most fun things that you can do, most rewarding things you can do. But in the same sense, if you're trying to provide for a family, sometimes if you want to grow as a person, it's hard to do it in those settings. Again, I'm glad that we stumbled on real estate, and most of that's probably based on from the era that we got hired at forced our hands to go do that.
So how long ago was it that you quit that job then? What year was it?
So we left in 2021. So we rolled out. Yeah, we rolled out in 2021 during COVID, during all the crazy stuff. We wound up refinancing a multifamily building that we had purchased, wound up basically clearing almost seven figures in proceeds and said, you know what? This is it. We're out of here. Let's go pursue real estate full time. And that's ultimately what we're doing.
So why don't you tell me, like, what year was it when you bought your first property, and like, how long were you working this part-time, like trying to do your firefighter job while also building your portfolio? And what was that like? Sounds like that would be a challenging thing.
Okay. So to go back on it, we bought our first rental property in 2012. I bought it in 2012. My business partner got started in wholesaling in roughly 2014. You got to remember all the things that were going on in this time frame from when we got hired in 2007, 2008. There was a ton of stuff going on. We were getting furloughed. Pension systems are going bankrupt. There's no overtime. They're closing companies. Our jobs are at risk, right? Like, we took government jobs to do all these different things. And long story short, I was like, dude, there's got to be a better way. So we were working two 10-hour days, two 14-hour nights, and then we would have 4 days off. We were all landscaping, construction, trades, whatever it was. We were always working side jobs. And I was like, dude, I'm not gonna be able to do this for 30 years. This is crazy. This is no way to live a life. And I said, well, how can we make money while we're asleep at work? That's what I was trying to figure out. And I just kept coming back to real estate. I was like, dude, real estate, real estate, real estate. If I'm asleep at work, I know that we're earning money. The other thing is, if I die, right, or I get severely injured in a fire, what would I be leaving my family or my kids? And at that point, I didn't have any kids. It was like, well, what am I leaving my wife if I'm gone? Like, how does she survive? Like, she couldn't pick up like a contracting business tomorrow and go execute that for me. And if we had open projects, it'd be a nightmare. But if we had cash flowing real estate and I pass, she can continue to cash flow it. She can hire a property manager. She could sell it all off and have the cash she needs to support her family. So that's ultimately how we stumbled on real estate. And in 2012, I bought a rental property. Like I said, my business partner started in the wholesaling side of things. Bought the first property for roughly $25,000. I can't say I did it right. Can't say I did it wrong. Did all the work ourselves. It was a big mess. Ultimately, we were probably into that project $50,000-$60,000. Again, I have no clue because I can't tell you I was some accounting wizard day one. It was a back of the napkin. I think I spent this type deal. And ultimately, we got $1,250 rent on that first one. And I was like, holy crap, man. And yeah, it was subsidized housing and we got really good rent. I was like, holy crap, I need to do that again. bought another one 6 months later and wound up growing to a portfolio of 10 really, really quick on my own. And then my business partner was wholesaling and stumbled on a package of properties. And that's just kind of how said, hey, can we join up and do this together? Because we grew up outside of Philadelphia together. And that's ultimately what created our company. But yeah, man, that 2012, just similar economic times to now. Like everything was uncertain. I didn't know how I was going to finance it. I didn't know where the cash was coming from. I had no clue. I just knew if I went out there and did this one project, I could get it done. And that's, I'm glad we took that leap of faith to go and do this.
Were you guys scared at all with that first property? I remember I bought my first duplex back in 2011. And I know there was just a lot of, I wasn't particularly scared because I knew I was getting, it was apparent that there was nowhere for it to go but up, but there was just a lot of fear in the environment. I mean, in the media and the world, everybody was just saying like real estate is a terrible thing to buy. Did you have to mentally deal with that at all? And if so, how did you get over it and just make the decision?
Yeah, I can't say that I had like the external like media forces. I have a little more of that today than I do then. But back then, it was a lot of just not knowing. So it was like I had blinders and I was like, well, I would have been 29 at that point. Okay, screw it. If I go and buy this house and if I lose it, all hell breaks loose. I still have this job to fall back on, whatever. I'll just work in the fire department for 30 years. I already have bad credit, whatever. I'll just pay it all off. So I didn't really have fears from that standpoint, but I did have a lot of like self-doubt of like, there's no way this is going to work. Well, what if this happens? What if that happens? Yeah, remember, I'm in a firehouse full of men, type A personalities, and it's always, oh, you're going to go do Section 8? You're going to be one of them slumlords. We go to those houses all the time. I was like, well, no, not actually. Like, this is actually how it works. And they're like, no, you're just going to be one of those ghetto slumlords. We're going to be at your house all the time. It'll never work. I knew this guy that this failed, and I knew that guy. And I just, at a certain point, I just had to compartmentalize it, probably the same way we compartmentalize a lot of, like, the bad stuff we saw at work. I just compartmentalized it and said, all right, I don't care what you're saying. I got to go do this for me. I'm going to go do it. And I did that first one and we're cash flowing like $500-$600 a month on the very first one. Everyone's like, dude, how'd you get a new truck? I'm like, well, I did this thing that everyone told me not to do, right? Like at a certain point, you just got to go like this and say, don't listen, man. Just don't listen. I did wind up with a mentor for a short period of time to kind of help me through it. But you know, this is pre-YouTube University. This is Bigger Pockets probably. Well, Bigger Pockets was in play, but I wasn't a big forum guy. I just read books is really what I did. Talked to everybody that I knew. I was going to real estate meetups, just trying to figure it all out. And that's how I got over that hurdle of taking the action. And again, like you have to take the action. Most people are afraid to even take that step. I look at it this way. If I didn't take that step, I'd still be working that job today. I would have never advanced forward. And it's not fair to my family, right? Like, yeah, at some point, you just got to put the blinders on and go. And I think that's the best thing that most people can do that are starting out.
Yeah, it is crazy how many people like stop themselves before they even get anywhere. Like they don't even give themselves a chance to like pursue something. They just kind of have this cancel out mentality of just like, it'll never work because of this. I saw this thing on TV once, or I have a friend who failed at that, so it'll never work. And I mean, I can even honestly look at myself and say that I've done that with certain things, like said no to good opportunities because I just wasn't willing to even think about it. It's a tough thing to know when to turn the blinders on, because on one hand, like there's wisdom in listening to criticism. You know, like there are ways that we can all be better, and we're kind of foolish to just say, forget you about everything. But there is a time when you do need to say that. So it's kind of tricky to discern and understand, like, when do I listen versus when do I just proceed and do what I know in my heart is right.
Yeah, in hindsight, look, hindsight's always 20, right? Hindsight's 20/20. None of us would knew that, like, we all believe that we would be this successful that we are today, right? And I think that's why we end up in these mastermind rooms of like, holy crap, how did I end up here? Like, I need to talk to someone else that had this crazy journey, right? Like, we have similar journey paths. And it's like, oh my God, like, yeah, like, this just happened and that happened. And like, you look back and you're like, wow, man, I can't believe I did all this in that short period of time. But then, if you go back to yourself then and try to look forward to say in 10 years, I'm going to have almost a 9-figure portfolio, or I'm going to have this massive following, and I'm going to have this huge podcast, like, or a portfolio, or flipping land, like whatever it is, you're like, there's no way, like there's just no way. Right. And a lot of people ask like, well, how did you even end up here? And I said, I don't know, man. And sometimes it's like, I don't even know if I could recreate it, right? But there was something there that motivated us to get to the other end. And when we talk about putting on blinders, we're not talking about putting on blinders and doing stupid deals. We're talking about canceling out all the noise from, yo, it might be your mom, it might be your wife, it might be your the most respected person that you know that says this is stupid. But if somewhere deep down inside, you know it's right, you're going to make it work, you have that burning desire, you're going to go. Most people give up. And we would see it all the time in Baltimore because we would get a lot of money come down from New York. We get a lot of money come up from D.C., Philadelphia, all the surrounding major cities. And they come in, oh, I can handle Baltimore, I can handle Baltimore. And they throw money at their problems, they give up. And next you know, there's more vacant houses, right? And you would see it all the time. Most people don't have the grit and determination to complete what they set out to do. And those that do, that is what gives them the ability to take the next step, to do the next deal, to grow the portfolio, to grow what they're doing. I'm Seth. I'm sure you can talk about it. Like, you probably remember your first podcast. It probably sucked. I look at my first podcast. It sucked. I guarantee you it was terrible. And it's like, well, if I didn't keep going back and just trying it out over and over and over again, I would never have one. You would never have one, right? Like, and most people, again, just they give up on themselves way too soon. It's not easy, right? Like, if it was easy, we would all do it. I give you all the cliche sayings, but they're all true, you know, every single one of them.
So let's talk about this portfolio. So are you saying, is your goal to get to 70 million or is it already there? Or where are you in that journey of getting to where you want to go?
Yeah, conservatively today, our portfolio aggregate value, assets under management of how much stuff we own and control is approximately $70 million of real estate. Our next major goal is obviously the nine-figure one, which if we close this next deal that we're potentially working on would take us right up to that. We're working on a $30 million acquisition. But yeah, we're already at the $70 million valuation point, and it's crazy to think, dude, we have no traditional training, no traditional background, just two guys that went out there and did it, and it's beyond achievable, right? Like, I remember talking, oh, I just want 100 houses, and then when we got to 100 houses, I was like, oh, that's cool, like, what's next? You know what I mean? And getting to $70 million, while it might seem like an astronomical number, it's actually not that hard. It's not that hard to get to the level that you want to be at. It goes back to how hard you want to work, how badly do you want it. So, but yeah, no, we're fortunate enough to have a $70 million portfolio. It's pretty cool.
This is an entity where it's owned by two people. Is that right? You and your business partner, Dan?
Yeah, Dan and I own the majority of it. Some of our deals are syndicated. We have investors that come in and invest side by side with us. We have some deals that we just own straight up. We have some deals that where we have full-blown, you know, equity partners that we're like, each a third ownership on, right? Like we do it in every different way. And it's like, you know, what you talk about in like land flipping or even wholesaling, it's all just a tool in the toolbox, right? Like, yeah, would it be cool that we own this portfolio and it was 100% ours? Sure. But would that portfolio value only be $7 million because we didn't leverage other people's, you know, whether it's their money, their expertise, whatever it is, it allowed us to get to that next step. And getting to the $70 million number, I don't want to say it was like important to us, but it's created scale with inside of our business that's hard for things to not stay in motion every single day, right? And that was part of some of the motive behind it. It was we wanted to be financeable, but we also wanted to have a business where it operates on its own and it's living and it's breathing. And not all the time do you need to have a dollar amount attached to that. But for us, it's like success is when the business can live and breathe on its own. I went on a golf trip last week with a few of our investors and we had some stuff happen. All I had to do was look at my phone at the end of the day. Like, I literally put my phone away for 8 hours and we played two rounds of golf, which is unheard of. I didn't answer my messages till we got back to the house. I saw we had an issue. Our project manager already had it handled. He had already contacted the insurance agent and a resolution was already in place. Our leasing agent inside of our office, she had already contacted the program to handle the stuff for the tenant. Like, things were already in motion, which is really cool. And when you look at it from that standpoint, what does scale give you? What does a $70 million portfolio give you over a $7 million portfolio? It's that full-blown autonomy, right? Like, it lives and breathes and operates on its own, and it's harder to stop than it is a one-man band that's like, okay, well, I feel like working today. I'm having a crap day. I don't feel like working today. I got this problem. I can't work today, right? Like, having that scale allows you to continue to grow, and growth is not just acquisitions. Growth is success of other people, monetary, purchasing new properties, but just great operations in general. That's all what growth is, and having this allows us to have that growth.
When I hear $70 million, even though that, you know, was built up over 10 plus years now, that number does kind of sound astronomical. I mean, it just seems like so far beyond anything. I'm just putting myself in the mind of a new person who's starting out. Maybe they have one rental property or something. To get to that point, I assume there were probably certain pivotal decisions or pivotal moments that helped you get there. Like maybe when you decided to do syndications or upgrading to a certain property type, or if somebody wanted to replicate your journey, or as you just look back at how you started with one rental property and now you have what you have today, like how did you do it? Like what were the things that really helped you get there and move the needle?
I would say there's a few things. One was always having an open mind, not always saying yes to every opportunity, but always having an open mind, understanding what other people are doing. I used to tell people we had an unfair advantage. Towards the end of our career, we were working 24-hour shifts. I'd be up all night. We'd be on, out on runs or fires. I'd just be scrolling other people's deals, how they break them down, what's going on. I was like literally consuming information 24/7, right? Like, so to me, that's one. It's just having an open mind and understanding what everyone's doing. Number two, and this is what I tell a lot of people, is we hyper-concentrated on single-family real estate. That is what we did. That is where we cut our teeth. That is where we learned everything. Acquisitions, dispositions, capital improvements, leasing agents, how to set up our leases, bank financing, because it's such a smaller amount. You get to understand the inner workings of the bank, how to set up a personal financial statement, all these different things. And in that growth process, it's like, man, okay, like I'm doing all this work for a $100,000 house. What if I could just find one multifamily property at $1 million? It's all the same work. Well, we had that opportunity. We had a deal come up that was about $500,000. It was the biggest purchase we ever did. We never did a commercial transaction. We just kept saying, all right, well, it's just seven houses once, right? Like that's how we looked at it. And I was like, okay, cool. We're done. Now here's the next set of hurdles. And by us cutting our teeth inside the single family space, we knew our process well. We knew what our team could handle. We knew that capital improvements is our favorite thing to do, and that's the best thing that we do. And we can handle CapEx better than most people. There's a burnt down shell. There's a, like, we bought a burnt down commercial building and renovated the whole thing. Everyone else was too scared to do it. We jumped in there and got it done, right? Like, we knew that from doing our single family stuff. And doing the single, and I'm not saying everyone needs to get into single family. You can get into flipping land. You can get into multifamily or self-storage. You can get into all those different asset classes day one. Whatever asset class you get into day one, go and dominate it. Become the number one in your asset class. Then you can start to look and say, you know what, man, this is nothing more than a widget machine. I stick a cog in the top and a widget comes out the bottom, right? And you're like, oh, man, that's cool. Okay, so now when we look at it from our standpoint, it's like, man, we did single family real estate. Great. The next natural progression was into multifamily. So then we did a multifamily deal. And we're like, man, we just did a commercial transaction. What does that look like? Oh, we kind of toyed around with some industrial spaces and some other stuff and some stuff that we like, some stuff that we don't. And then we stumbled on storage. And now it's like, okay, well, we're really good at storage. We're really good at multifamily. Those are our two favorite things to do. But like, right now, at the time of this recording, April of 2023, we're literally wholesaling a single family house because it came through our network of people that we know. And they said, hey, I got this deal. I got this property that I inherited. Do you want it? And we said, yeah. And we're about to make almost 70 grand on it. But again, it's a tool in the toolbox. You know, so by doing single family real estate really well, it has graduated us into other asset classes that are much bigger and better and have more growth opportunity, but we're still not also too good to not do what we know how to do really well. And I would say to me, that's the number one thing you can do is get really good at one thing.
What are all the different property types currently in your $70 million portfolio?
So we hyper concentrate on self-storage and multifamily. That's, we have a lot of that. we have a pretty decent sized single family portfolio. And then we have a few Airbnbs and some industrial stuff and some commercial space. Pretty eclectic, but we spend the majority of our time sourcing multifamily deals in the Baltimore metro area within a two-hour radius and self-storage properties pretty much east of Texas, the majority of the markets that we look at. That's where we spend most of our time. And again, it was like, man, like we started dabbling in industrial and office space and all these different things. And it was like Airbnbs. It's like, I don't know, man. Like there's great runway in storage. There's great runway in multifamily. It's like, let's just capitalize on those two things and be really good at them. And yeah, if we stumble on some of this other stuff like land development or anything else, yeah, we'll pop our heads in. We're not too good not to understand it. But in the same sense, like if it's too complex over a hairy of a deal, I'm out. Or I'm going to call one of my boys, yo, Seth, piece of land, what do you want to do here? Or whoever it is, like, yo, I got this. What do you want to do with this? And again, that's going to masterminds and building networks and understanding what you're good at or what you're not. And also saying, you know what, do the right thing by other people. And like, you know, so that's really the breakdown of the portfolio plus some of my my spin on life. So didn't mean to get off topic there.
But it does make me wonder. A couple minutes ago, you just said to hyper-focus on one thing, but it sounds like you're doing a lot of different things. So when you say thing, are you not referring to property type? Do you mean something different by that? Or
No, I would say that initially you want to hyper-concentrate on one asset type, right? And then you're going to find out. Like, let's just say, yeah, initially. And then you kind of go through phases, right? Like, you get bored. Like, you can only do so many storage deals or so many single-family houses. You're like, oh, this is boring. What are the Airbnbs doing? Because they're sexy and everyone's talking about it. And you go do an Airbnb and you're like, yeah, I should have just stayed in my lane, right? Like, so that happens. And when I say thing, it's just like, okay, and you might even do single-family real estate really well, and you might do CapEx really well, and you're a terrible property manager. Okay, well, now you know in your process, I can buy them and fix them. I'm a terrible manager. Great, I need to find a management option. So then when that multifamily deal comes up, guess what? You're not magically overnight going to become a better manager. You're going to look at it, and you're not going to buy a deal that needs management improvements. You're going to buy a deal that needs a ton of CapEx, and you got to go source a property manager. And again, by doing your one asset class or your one thing really, really well, then you can start rolling that into different deals. So like for us, it's been when we cut our teeth in single family real estate, my business partner and my project manager, super good operators from the capital improvement standpoint, from keeping tenants accountable. They're really good at that. I got really good by default of doing the capital stack and all the other crap. So with that said, like when I look at a deal, I look at it and say, well, how does my, okay, now let's just say like we go from single family to multifamily, natural progression, right? So when I'm looking at them, I was always looking at them from a financial standpoint. Then I would take them and say, hey, Dan, like, I think this makes sense. Can you and Ryan handle the CapEx and operations side of things? And they would say yes or no. And then that's how we naturally progressed into a deal. It's like, okay, well, we can do this. I collectively, they're really good at that. I'm really good at this. Now let's go do that deal. And we grew. And that's how you grow over time naturally, is executing what you're really good at. Like a friend of mine, Jason, who's a co-host on my podcast, he's a hard money lender. And he's a terrible, terrible property owner. He'll tell you this. Terrible property owner. He actually sold all of his properties and was like, I'm never owning another property again unless I have an operator in place. And he took his money and he rolled them into his hard money loans. Well, then when we started doing bigger storage deals and multifamily deals, I said, hey, Jason, like we always wanted to work together. There was never enough money to split on single family. But now I have this opportunity with storage and multifamily. Are you interested in investing? Well, that got his itch for wanting to own properties without the headaches. And then we started doing deals where it was like, hey, Jason, you can do a hard money loan and you can buy some equity. And it kind of like gives him the best of both worlds. And off we went. So that's been pretty cool and fun to execute on that side of things, because you'd start to notice what people are really good at. And he would tell you the same thing, is like, I don't want to own properties. I'll lend on them. I'll find a way to do equity in deals, but I will never personally own and operate a deal on my own again. And I think that's the level of maturity that it takes after a while of just being like, hey, like, you need to recognize who and what you are. And again, like, Seth, I think you know, just sitting in the mastermind room, most people aren't honest with themselves. And that's why you need to sit in that room so someone can call your BS out and just be like, dude, you're lying to yourself. Like, you're telling us one thing, but your personality's coming out the other way. And that's what's so fun about those rooms, because then when someone goes, ooh, you guys are right, and you see it click, and then it's just like a mind-altering experience from them, and then they go out and crush for the next several years. And it's a beautiful thing to watch, and that's what's helped me advance. I'm sure it's helped you advance and many other people advance, just being in those rooms and having people hold you accountable.
Yeah, it is pretty crazy how easy it is for me to see and diagnose another person's problem, but how hard it is to diagnose my own problem. It's like I'm too close to it, you know? Even though, like, it actually is kind of obvious to me deep down, it's like I still don't see it because I have my biases and my, you know, I have a vested interest in things going a certain way, and I just, there's so many blind spots. But getting other people who can just kind of point out your flaws and problems, it goes a long way.
Yeah, no, there's nothing worse than getting, like, you spend the day in the room and you're like, hey, man, you should try this, or hey, man, you should try that. And then you get up there and you tell the same exact problem you just heard for like the last 2 days. And you're like, I am the world's biggest fraud right now because I know exactly what. But that's why you sit in there, because like when you start calling, a lot of times what happens is it's like self-reflection and you're like, hey, like, you know, if I'm sitting there, I'm like, hey, Seth, try this. And then I'm like, I just told Seth to try that. I'm not even doing that in my own business. What a genius idea. Or I get up there and I'm like, hey, I got the same problem as Seth. And I just say it in a different way. And you're like, Ian, you just told me how to fix this problem. Like, what are you doing right now? And you're like, darn it. You need to be humbled every once in a while, right? Like, it just, everyone needs it. And it happens. So, and the fact that most people, I know this isn't a mastermind conversation, but that's where we met. And it's just like, most people are too afraid to even explore their weaknesses, right? And again, like going back to the beginning of this conversation, most people are afraid to try something. But if they would have sat in a mastermind room before they ever got involved in real estate and really spend the time to say, man, like if time and money were no object, what do I really want to do? Well, it's not sit there and go work for, you know, Columbus, Ohio, they have a bunch of big brands out there. Like, I think a couple guys were from Bath and Body Works or whatever it was. Like, it's not sit there and work for Bath and Body Works. I want to be at all my kids' games. I want to have the freedom and the time freedom to go out to all my kids' games and coach football. And like, all right, cool. Like, let's build a lifestyle around that. You know what I mean? And I just think it's like important, and people should concentrate and invest in themselves, whether it's going to mastermind rooms, it's journaling, meditating, whatever your morning routine is, it's working out, whatever that outlet is for you to free your brain and allow you to break the mold of what they consider normal. And that's, for me, the college route, I'm out on college, the W-2 route, I'm out on the W-2 route, right? Like, whatever it is for you to break the mold and control your time, I think that's uber important for people to spend time and do, and it will change the trajectory of your life more than your wildest dreams. Just remember, I should go find pictures and give them to you of me when fireman. Like, I was literally just a dumb fireman that wanted to go to fires, and we've built this massive portfolio. Yes, some of it's by pure accident, and a lot of it's by grit and determination, but knowing what we want, that we didn't want to go work for a department for 30, 40 years and being stuck and a slave to the man, you know? Sorry, you got me on a rant. I apologize.
No, man. I do that all the time. Rants are fun, aren't they? Going back to your journey here, and maybe I've sort of asked this, but just in a different way, but if you're starting over today, given all of the different types of properties you worked with, if your goal was to recreate the wheel and go from one property to $70 million portfolio as quickly as possible, is there a certain property type or strategy or anything that you would focus your efforts on and double down on to get there faster? Or did you just have to bump in the walls and do all this stuff to make it work?
No, I would say it's not so much of like what I would have done. It's having confidence in myself earlier. If you don't mind, I'll rephrase the question. If I lost it all today and I had to go build it again today, what would I do? I would go back. I would do some single family real estate, get my feet wet again, right? Like, make sure I have my team, my processes in place, and I would jump to commercial assets much quicker. We've always been legacy owners, cash flow owners. That's always what I look at. I would make the jump from single family real estate to commercial real estate a lot quicker. The rewards are much larger. The willingness for people to invest in you, invest in your deals, the room for people to invest in your deals, the opportunity is much, much larger. And the other cool thing is, and I think this gets missed a lot, in single family real estate, like, it's consumer to business owner, where in commercial real estate, it's B2B. So when you ask for owner financing, or you ask for help, or whatever it is, generally speaking, most business operators want to see other business operators succeed. And they're like, oh, yeah, you know what? Like, I remember when I had that issue. Yeah, I'll hold a note for you, but here's the terms. I think there's more creativity inside of commercial real estate, and I would hop on that train a lot faster than I did from the single family world. I'd pick up a few single family houses to get immediate cash flow, just because it's the easiest and the path of least resistance. And then after that, I would jump to commercial real estate as fast as humanly possible and get in there and do it, because, like I said, the opportunity's much greater than it is in the single family world, from my opinion, from a growth standpoint and a legacy ownership standpoint.
I don't know why I've never put that together, the significant difference between business to business versus business to consumer, because you're right. I mean, that's just like a totally different mindset. Although when you're dealing with like apartment buildings or self-storage, that's not necessarily business to business, right? So when you say commercial real estate, because of that benefit, is there a specific kind that you're thinking of, like a office space or something, or triple net lease, or?
Yeah, the owners are just a little more sophisticated in multifamily, storage, commercial real estate in general, right? Like, when I say B2B, they have more of a business mindset. Let's think about this situation.
You're talking about like purchasing a property, right? Not renting a property?
Yeah, let's think about this situation, right? Grandma has a house. She dies. She leaves it to her four kids. Those four kids are fighting over, because this is the penny that's going to... They inherited this house. It's worth $1 billion. It's going to get them all out of debt. Okay. Well, that was just grandma's house. It's worth 50 grand. Y'all out of your mind, and I'm not dealing with all this drama. Now, grandma owns a self-storage facility or the multifamily property in town. She dies, but she's had such a successful life. This wasn't her only prized possession. She passes it down to her kids, who are successful. They say, you know what? This was grandma's business. I don't want to own it. I want to sell it. Okay, cool. We come along and say, hey, we want to buy your multifamily or your self-storage property. And we start talking to them and be like, yeah, you know, like, this is a family business. We want to create the family and whatever else. And, you know, this is what we're going to do for our kids and this and the other thing. And they go, you know what? Like, we would never have the opportunity to sell this multi-million dollar asset to you without grandma. And I recognize that. Or grandma had such massive success. We would love to see you have success with it. We just never had the opportunity to follow in grandma's footsteps. So we're happy to sell it to you. There's a much more motive to do business, whether it's getting the asset sold. There's pressure from banks. Like, there's a lot more reason for commercial real estate to move. Whereas in single family, it's a lot of the D's, right? Divorce, death, and I forget the other one, whatever it is. But like, divorce and death are like the two motivators for people to trade, right? Versus in commercial real estate, yeah, you got those two things, but you also have like, hey, it's time to move on. I want to upgrade asset classes, or the bank's calling my loan, or grandma did pass on and she had such great success with it and we all have better lifestyles because of it. I'm happy to sell this to you at a reasonable price on reasonable terms, right? Like, I'll give you an example. We bought a 76-unit multifamily property. And when she called us, she said, hey, like, I saw you guys wrote a book and whatever. Like, I'm really interested to talk to you guys. And the short story long is, she's like, look, my mom's sick. It costs her about $20,000 a month for her to survive. I want to owner finance this property to you so I have cash flow. And we're talking about a $5 million asset. And I'm like, okay, how much do you want to owner finance? I'm thinking like 10 or 15%. She's like, yeah, I want to underfinance 90% of it for tax benefits and the cash flow. So me and Dan sat down and we're like, okay, well, how do we get her $20,000 a month? This is what the loan terms would look like. Because she told us, like, hey, like, my parents had great success with this. It made them a lot of money. I have no heirs under me. I just want to get this sold so my mom has cash flow every single month to take care of her and her family. Or take care of her with full-blown nursing staff in her house, because she didn't want to put her in a nursing home. So when we figured that out, it was like a true B2B type situation, in my opinion, because she had to get this deal done to get the cash flow to pay for her mother. And I was like, okay, well, we have the cash and we want this property and we're happy to pay you on a monthly basis because you're giving us this massive jump into the next asset class for us. So it was like, it's a win-win for both of us. Whereas I remember like fighting on the phone with people on over $25,000 houses and they think it's worth 26. And I'm like, dude, I'm not giving you a dollar more than 25 and blow deals up over nothing. You know what I mean? And that's why I think commercial real estate has more motivation and the more likelihood for deals to get done on a larger scale with more reasonable terms. Yes, you're going to run into the Donald Trumps of the world or whoever is like, yo, this is it. Like, I control the situation. I'm top dog. But there's also still very reasonable people out there to do deals in the commercial world. And I think that's why it provides the opportunity that will allow everyone to succeed.
Getting me curious, how do you find your deals? I know it probably varies when you're talking about single family homes versus $30 million purchases. But, you know, I just what's your secret sauce for that? Is it like direct mail or are you just working through brokers or I don't know? Where do you go to find these properties?
I'm going
to
tell you the most bland answer that you have ever heard. The number one way we get deals in the commercial space, let's just push single family to the side. Commercial deals, I invest in the broker network. I know it sounds stupid. It sounds crazy. We spend most of our time curating relationships with brokers. And I'll tell you why. In the commercial world, there's a few things. Once you, like that 76 unit apartment building, when we bought that off market, that was a unique situation. Every broker was calling us saying, yo, dude, like, how'd you get that deal done? So the brokers are paying attention to who's buying and selling. You get credibility when you do that. Number one. Number two, dude, you find a broker that's similar in age or a little bit younger. Like, I got this buddy of mine, Jake, out of Alabama. We've connected. I'm a huge Philadelphia Eagles fan. So Jalen Hurts, Devontae Smith, a few other guys are on the team. So we talk about that type of stuff. But then we did a deal. We did a $12 million deal together. Dude, he calls me all the time. Yo, dude, like, I got this deal. I got this deal. I got this deal. I'm in his first five contacts of people to talk to. He got this $27 million deal that's never going to market. And he called me and Dan. I'm like, dude, you got much more sophisticated buyers. He's like, yeah, but I like working with you because you don't play the retrade game. You get deals done. Well, then he start, yo, his boys and Marcus and Millichap and that whole crew of people, they're like, yo, Jake, how are you selling all these deals? Oh, I got my boy Ian. Well, next you know, they're all calling me with like, yo, I got this deal, I got this deal, I got this deal, right? Like, so curating that broker network, that's like one side of it. The other side of it is, it goes back to what we were just talking about, the whole B2B thing. They got what I want. I got what they want. We just need to find that strike price, right? Like, I want the property. They want money. Brokers are known to be, they need their money because they're always spending it. Okay, well, broker, you're spending your money. Do your thing. I'm going to come along and buy a deal. And guess what? Like, the market just got a little hairy. They're like, hey, like, I got all these deals. Yo, just make an offer. Just make an offer. I'm like, oh, now all of a sudden you want, like, BS offers from us? That's fine. I'll start shooting you offers that I believe are right for the price. Next, you know, they're going to bat for us because the market is turned and they know that they need us, right? So I always spend a lot of time curating broker relationships. It's not just buying deals. It's like if I see a deal and I'm like cruising Crexy and LoopNet and all the other different sites, I'm like, man, that seems like an interesting deal. Hey, broker, what's up? Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm kind of interested in that deal. Like, I'm just not at your price point. Like, what do you think it takes to get done? Just open the conversation. And I always like to just tell them some stupid price. And they're like, yeah, you're so far off base. But like, all right, cool. Well, you just let me know if it doesn't trade. And when it doesn't trade, guess what? They're going to call you and be like, hey, listen, like, I know you made that like ridiculous offer, but like, think you come up by a few bucks? I think I can get it done, right? Like, they don't want to have that tarnished on their record that they didn't get a deal done, right? So with that being said, it's like it's uber important that, you know, working the broker network, getting the deals done, knowing what they have at market and staying in tune. And just like I just talked to a broker the other day. I haven't talked to in about a year, and he reached out and he said, hey, man, I'm thinking about you on this deal. It's kind of fits your buy box. Like, you should take a look at it. I said, hey, man, it's in South Dakota. Like, it's not in my buy box, but thanks for thinking of me. The fact that he even thought of me and his Rolodex of people, that means a lot that he knows that we're active buyers. So I would say the number one thing you can do is work that broker network. That is the most important thing that we do on the commercial side of real estate to get deals done. Let me just finish this statement out. That's why we like using them. When I curate that relationship with them, this is a career-long relationship. Think about that 76-unit apartment building. Well, it's blossomed into a lot more today. What if that was just a one-off transaction? There's nothing to say when you curate that relationship with a direct-to-market seller that there's going to be anything behind it. There isn't. They might only own one property. They want their money, and they're going to go run to the hills, and you're never going to hear from them again. I have to restart the process every single time with them. Hey, my name's Ian. We're firemen, blah, 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 blah. Here's the story. Here's the song and dance. And you're just like massaging them. I'm willing to pay a few dollars more to the brokers to get the deals done, but they already know my story. They know my buy box. They know everything that I want to do, and I don't have to restart the relationship. That relationship is growing and blossoming at all times.
Yeah, it makes a ton of sense, man. So it sounds like something that, like, you don't just turn that on overnight. That takes years to curate that and make it turn into something substantial, right?
Yeah, 100%. And I would tell your listeners, I don't know what your audience is, how sophisticated or non-sophisticated they are, but if you're just getting started in real estate and you, like, truly want to be in the commercial space, whatever that is to you, yo, pick up the phone and talk to a broker. Be like, yo, listen, I'm not going to lie to you. I'm completely new. I'm looking at this deal. Don't go and ask them what does NOI mean and cap rate and all these other silly things. But look at the deal and call them up and say, hey, man, like, I'm interested in this deal. Like, I see your cash flow numbers. They don't really make sense to me. Can you, like, you know, give me a little idea? And some of the brokers, they're just as clueless. Other brokers will really take the time. They're like, yo, I think if you do X, Y, and Z, it's really worth this, but the current owner doesn't want to do that, right? And then you start putting the things together, just having the conversations that people recognize you. Every once in a while, you get a broker who's like, yo, dude, like, I want to see you have some starting power. Like, let's go. And they'll help you launch to that next level, right? Like, again, if you have success, they have success, they have another buying client, and off they go. You know what I mean? So I would say, if you see a deal, don't be shy. Go take a look at it. Keep it moving, you know? So,
in your experience, are brokers not a fan of seller financing? Like, do they try to steer you away from that or anything? Or is it not really a material thing?
Yeah, usually they are so worried about how they're going to get paid. So let's just say there's a seller financing deal and you're going for 100% seller financing. It's hard. Because they want the transaction that's the path of least resistance, and they know there's enough cash for them to get paid. And they start looking at it going, well, there's not enough money for me to get paid. Like, how am I going to have this conversation, right? So I would say most of the time, that they don't understand and they don't want to present it because they don't want that layer of complexity. They want the path of least resistance to get a deal done. So usually what I do early in the conversation, it's like, hey, is the owner available, you know, open to any owner financing? Like, I don't need it because we have the wherewithal to do the deal. But is it something that they would entertain if I could get them a little higher price? Because owner financing is a huge deal, right? Like, you might be willing to pay a few more bucks. And just like pacing it, I think that's what it's called. I'm not a big sales guy, but, you know, pacing and leading is like, you kind of put it out there, you let it die. Then if there's some hair around the deal and you're like, no, I'm stuck at this price. And the broker's like, well, he's stuck at this price. That's a great time to bring it up, to be like, I might give him most of his price if he or she is willing to owner finance X, Y, and Z, right? Like, you had the conversation early on. It went nowhere. Fine. You continue looking at the deal and then you try it again. But a lot of the times early on, most of them just put it to bed because they don't feel like dealing with all the terms and the crap, and they're not bankers, you know what I mean? They don't want the back and forth. Owner financing is better suited one-on-one situations with sellers.
Thinking back to when you got started to where you are now, like, what were the biggest challenges back then and what are they now? How has that changed over the years?
The biggest challenges back then was, how are we going to finance this? How are we going to get paid? How does all this crap work? Now our biggest challenge is, and I can go more in depth to that if you want, but now our biggest challenge is personnel, right? Our job now is to recruit the best talent, recruit the best deals, recruit the best vendors. So a lot of our time and a lot of our challenges revolve around, you know, finding talent, growing a team, you know, executing at the next level of like, what does growth look like? You know, we went from flying by the seat of our pants to having to have budgets every year. We went from, we don't need any employees to now we have 13, you know, we never worried about unemployment. Now you got to worry about unemployment, right? So the challenges, they remain the same. You just view them in a different standpoint because like the budget comment revolves around how do we get paid, right? Like, that's still an early on challenge. It's still a challenge tomorrow, but now we got to do a lot more projections to make sure that that happens. The challenges are a little different. They're a little more like, I was never a corporate guy, but I would presume more of like C-level suite type stuff of like, you know, talent and growth and what does the next phase look like and, you know, dispositions of assets. Like, that's the challenges we face today. Whereas at the beginning, I think the challenges are all of it at the beginning. You know, and once you start to hit some stride, your first, your next major hurdle is hiring someone. Once you hire that one person, that challenge remains the same all the way through. It's just recruiting the best talent you can find and the best deals that you can find. But yeah, man, it's a little different, but it's all the same. It's problem solving. It's firefighting, right? Like, that's what we do. We put fires out on a daily basis and try to remain proactive. And if the fire's burning, we don't go to bed until the fire's out. The end. You know,
how many people are on your team now?
We have 13 employees, and technically we have one overseas employee, Rowena. Love you. She does all of our social media content. So technically we have 14 team members that are with us. Some of them are part time. Some of them are full time. It's just crazy to think, man. It is absolutely crazy. We have a head of management. We have a head of operations. It's growing into a true tree. And it's just amazing what it looks like as it grows. Because then it's like, oh, well, it wouldn't be hard to fill this position if we just do this and we can monetize this here. As like, boom, next you know, you got bookkeeping or accounting. You got in a full-blown accounting department at a blink of an eye. You know what I mean? So it's real interesting to watch that side of the business grow and growing a team. It's fun, man. It's not growth because we want to buy more. It's growth because Ryan, who runs our operation, hey, Ryan, like, you want to buy some deals this year? Yeah, cool, great. We go out hunting. Hey, man, I'm overwhelmed. All right, well, cool. Like, the growth is behind the people. Like, we truly concentrate on the people now, what they want, what their growth looks like. And the growth trajectory is not just about me and Dan anymore. It's about the team. It's about family. Dude, like, we look at it as we're responsible for 14 families, dude. Like, we have a lot of mouths to feed every single week. And that takes a lot of work to put the food on the table. It's just crazy to think, dude. But it's also awesome. It's beyond rewarding is how we look at it.
How do you spend your typical day now? I mean, if you got this huge team and they're doing all these odds and ends, like, I assume you get to choose how you want to spend your time, or you get to choose, I'm going to make this job for myself in the organization. Like, what job have you chosen and why?
Yeah. So oddly enough, I end up, maybe not oddly, I am the face of the company. No, I spend most of my time going out. I'm kind of like the chairman, the board, the president. I like to go out and talk and promote our company. I do a lot of the investor relations stuff and the acquisitions and the capital stack. I like the finance side of things, and I like talking to people. Naturally, early on, my business partner, he wound up going down the operations and accounting route. I went down the everything else route. So I wound up doing the acquisitions. I wound up doing investor relations. I do the taxes, right? Like, I do all the everything else that falls to the bottom. So a daily day is usually, you know, get up relatively early, do my thing, go for a walk. I like to get in between 8 and 9, kind of do all my important tasks in the morning, lunch hits, and then usually the afternoon's creative, free form, free flowing. I still go to the office every day. I haven't really figured out how to let go because I enjoy this a lot. I really do. I like being here. I like being surrounded. I'm in our Philly office right now. We're both moving back to Philadelphia. So we have one employee up here. I spend a lot of time with her. Dan's still in Baltimore for the time being. So he spends a lot of time with our team down there. But I like going to the office every day. Like, I can't imagine going and sitting on a beach every day. It's just not who we are. Like, we will continue to grind till the day we die, which I hope is another 40, 50 years from now, going out there and killing and doing deals, because you know what? It's fun. It's easy. It's rewarding. And I just enjoy being in the office and having conversations. Look, we all have crap days Everyone does. We're all human beings. Some days it's like I'm blowing the day off, or I'll just sit here and watch YouTube all day. I'm a human too. It happens, dude. But yeah, man, that's what we do. It's a lot of, I wish it was sexier. I wish I told you I flew on private jets and I spend my days on yachts. It's just, I don't think I can let go. There's seasons. My season right now is to execute. This summertime, I might slow down a little bit and spend a little more time on the boat and golf and go flying. But I still need to be, I tell everyone, I need 4 hours every day. Just give me 4 hours, 3 to 4 hours. Let me sit behind the computer. It could be from 6 to 10. It could be from 10 to 12. It could be whatever the time frame is. Just let me sit in front of the computer for a few hours. Let me get my work done. I feel completed for the day. We can go do whatever else you want after that. I'm not good at going to do fun stuff and then trying to turn it on later in the day. Because to me, at that point, the day's blown. So that's why I like getting in the office every day and grinding a little bit and then going out and having fun afterwards.
Yeah, well, that makes perfect sense. So with this big team you've built, I assume you must have a way to reliably and repeatably find good talent and manage these people so that everybody's functioning at their highest level and all this stuff. How do you do that? Like, how do you know you're talking to the right candidate? I'm sure you probably haven't always gotten it right, but do you have any tools for that or any methods or processes you go through to feel confident about who you're hiring and knowing you're getting the A player?
Dude, we've lucked out in our network so far. Talent usually presents itself. I think we're relatively good people, like we're good at recognizing personalities early on from the fire department, from dealing with some days, the worst of the worst and the best of the best people in their worst situation. You can immediately recognize how people are going to act. And I like to think that we're relatively good at identifying that early on through interview processes. We use the power of our network. I know, again, like I think I've hit every single cliche today, so I apologize to your audience. I'm normally not like this, but it's true, is the power of your network, dude. Like, we have a few guys that work with some guys that come from the recovery scene. We've had really good luck with people who are trying to start over, and they've been clean, and it's been powerful because it's also a give back, right? Like, we are able to navigate that process, and it's been able to help people build a new lifestyle. And with that being said, it's like we've always just talked to our network like, hey, man, we're looking for so-and-so, or hey, we're looking for this, or we're looking for that. Some of our stuff's come from Indeed, just having good job descriptions. But a lot of our like top-level team players have come from people we've known, telling people what we got going on, wearing our heart on our sleeve. Hey, like, we're looking for this person. Like, Ryan, the guy who runs our operation, he was a contractor that we were working with all the time, and we approached him and just said, hey, Ryan, look, we're looking to hire a project manager. That's what it was that the position was at the time. You interested in converting? And he was like, yeah, you know, like, interested. And that blossomed into a lot more. Our head of management, it's a friend of ours' wife, and it was just like, I was talking to him about the problem. He's like, hey, you should talk to my wife. Like, we're childhood friends. He's like, look, I don't want there to be any beef. Okay, fine. So we sat down, we had a few discussions, and it was like immediately we knew it was the right fit. So it's, I tell people, it's almost like when you get married, like you just know, you know? And again, interviewing a ton. Don't make a rash decision and just be like, hey, I'm going to hire this person. Unless you're one of those people that are willing to hire and fire. We're not. Like, we're cash flow guys, right? It's the same thing when we hire someone. Like, yo, we're hiring you into the family, and like, hopefully you stay with us for a long period of time. We're not interested in playing the hire fire game, because it's a lot of freaking work to be hiring and firing all the time, you know? So
I've heard you mention the DISC profile before. So what are you, and why do you think it's so important for a person to understand who they are?
Yeah, DISC personality, man. I think that's the best thing. You want to identify, this goes into hiring, this goes into investors, this goes into contractors, this goes into everything. Once you understand the DISC personality test, go Google search Tony Robbins DISC personality. Go take the test. You'll find out who you are. I'm personally a D and an I. Coincidentally, that's our parent company name is D and I Development. But I'm a high D decision maker, and I'm a high I. I'm a talker. I'm a all over the place kind of guy. My business partner is a D and an S. They're a great couple because he's supportive, wants to get stuff done, makes it like, he's got to trust to verify, get stuff done over and over and over again, where I'm like, let's go, let's go, let's go. So we push and pull each other, but we're both D's and we have the ability to make decisions. C's are great for accounting and lawyers and engineers and stuff like that. But you want to recognize who you are. You want to recognize your investors, like, you're never going to tell an investor, go take a dispersonality test. But when you understand a dispersonality, you see a C personality type come through the door, you might be like, man, that's, I'm out. Like, I'm not going to deal with you because you're going to ask me way too many questions. Whereas someone comes in through as like a D or an S, you're like, man, they're going to make a decision and they're going to support everything we're going to do. I'm in. So yeah, dispersonality is really key to understanding who you are and recognizing what type of talent you should surround yourself with.
I am a pretty strong S, which first time I heard that, I was like really disappointed because it's like, man, that's like that an employee. Like, that's just a soldier that follows orders all day and just gets to work. I felt like a lack of significance in that, but it's true. Like, I rock and roll and get stuff done all day long. Like, if you tell me what to do, I'm going to knock it out so good. But that's kind of where I thrive. And I'm actually pretty weak in the D category. Like, I have a hard time thinking big picture and direction and dreams of ideas and that kind of thing. Like, I actually need somebody like you in my life to like give me ideas on what to do, and then I can execute it. It's helpful to understand this, you know?
Yeah, but the fact that you recognize it now, it's like, okay, I got to go challenge this piece of me to try to get to the next level or fix whatever problems I have inside my... But yeah, man, that's huge. Once you recognize it, then it's like, it'll keep coming back over and over and over again.
Well, Ian, we're kind of getting to the end of our conversation here. I haven't done this in a while. When we have time, I like to ask three final questions of the people that we interview, just to kind of figure out more about how you tick and how you think. So I'll just jump right into those. So the first question is, what is your biggest fear?
Straight up, it's just failure, man. I fear failure a lot. Now I'm just going to unload on you here for a second. But the reason I fear it is, you know, just some childhood stuff. And, you know, where we came from is I don't want to go back, you know. I think that's what motivates us a lot, is that fear of failure and wanting to have this success. I know it sounds stupid. It's like, oh, if you fail, then you're learning. But there's also a fear of, like, failure, of, like, what it does to the soul. So for me, that's a huge fear of mine.
And what is that? What does failure mean to you? Like, how do you define that?
Yeah, failure. Shoot. I almost cursed again. See, now you just get way too deep. What does failure mean to me, honestly?
For a lot of people say failure to this question, and it just makes you wonder, like, how do you define that? And why don't you call it a lesson learned instead of a failure? Because failure is conclusive, and a lesson is like, hey, I'm getting better.
Yeah, you know, and I think that goes to, like, some of the stuff that is compartmentalized in here somewhere. I don't know where, but it's like, yeah, man, like, you're right. If I said, well, it's just a lesson learned, then it's like, okay, well, then fear is nothing to be scared of. But I think the reason I'm scared of it is I've had some other failures in my life and fallen flat on my face. And it's like, man, like, I just don't want to go back there. So for, like, failure to me is like setting out to go do something at a high level. And then just like, it just like completely like blows up. And it's like, man, it's a failure. And sometimes, yeah, it is just a lesson learned. And other times, when it crushes the soul, to me, that's when it's truly defined as a failure. And those are the ones that you got to watch out for, that don't take you down the rest of this nasty road of, I'm never going to do this again, and the whole nine. And that's when people get stunned and don't want to try and don't want to put themselves out there. And I think maybe just my personality type, I like being out there and I like doing things, that if that type of failure happened and I couldn't have outlets like this, that'd be really, really scary to me.
Yeah, there's a guy named Francis Chan. He's got a famous quote where he said, our greatest fear should not be of failure, but of succeeding at things in life that don't matter. And that's another way to think about it. Because, like, there's a whole lot of stuff that we place a lot of importance on, but it doesn't matter. Like, it has no lasting consequence. It's a very material, temporary thing that just doesn't add up to much. I think a lot of life is like that, especially for people who are achievers. Like, we work so hard and place so much emphasis on these certain goals, and we get them and we're like, that's it? Seriously? Like, I put all that effort into this? Things just don't have the same luster when you actually have them and you've achieved them. So, huh, another thing worth thinking about. So question number two, what are you most proud of?
I am most proud of, this will be a selfish answer, because I'm always proud of my girls and my family and everything that they do. But selfishly, I'm proud of everything that we've created. When, again, like, I think we talked about it earlier in the podcast, to sit there as a new investor and try to look 10 years in the future, I only could think about having 100 houses. And now when I look backwards, 100 house was such a stupidly small goal. And what we have today to be proud of, our 14 team members, the lives that we've created for all of them, the lives that we've created for ourselves, like that's, I'm like literally speechless, right? Like that's, it's huge to me. And it's just, I can't even imagine what we've accomplished. And I can't imagine what the future looks like knowing what we know that we've done in this 10 short years.
Now, suppose you just got $100 million wired to your bank account and you're not allowed to stay on your current career path. So real estate is out, but you can do anything else you want for the rest of your life. What would you do?
I would probably be an investor in other people's deals. It's my way around not being in real estate, but I would invest in other deals or other businesses, right? Like I like be that team effort. I like being a part of something. I like helping other people and motivate them getting to where they're going, right? Like if you look at it, I motivate my investors to go do their own deals too, because I want them to make more money so we can all invest together and we can grow together. So for me, it would be investing in some sort of business. If I had that kind of money, I'd probably look at the airline industry because I like flying. I've recently gotten my private pilot's license and I enjoy flying. But anything that is really something that's fun and that we can explore what we are and utilize what we do well from, you know, stacking capital and standpoint and just getting out there and doing it. And I guess maybe like with $100 million of like free cash, like maybe I would take like a day off and go do something fun with the family. But I can't guarantee that would happen. But I would definitely want to be a part of some sort of operating business and just exercise our brain power that we have today. And you never know. Maybe we all get that one day, just magically, boom, in the bank account. So I'll let you know when that happens.
Just from what I've observed of you and heard you say, it sounds like you're a gifted team builder. If that's true, that's an amazing thing. That's a gift that many people don't have, including me. I've thoroughly assessed myself. That's not one of my core areas of competence. But I know other people like yourself who are very good at that. And I got to tell you, it's a huge service to everybody who gets to be on your team. Because essentially what you're doing is you're making room for them. You're giving them opportunity that they wouldn't otherwise have. And especially when you enjoy it and when that's a life-giving activity for you, it makes it all the better. Like people on your team recognize that. And I think it brings them to life too. And I want to encourage you, if that's something that you know you're good at, like keep doing that. Like I would say, do it until your last breath, because it doesn't just serve you. It serves everybody who gets to work with you.
100%. Oh, yeah. I've been in some conversations, people are like, and not just in business, and sometimes it'd be around the firehouse, people are like, dude, I'm ready for war, I'm going to go run through a brick wall, like, after that. I'm like, man, I'm just talking, having a good time, like, but you know what, if you can motivate someone, and whether it's on your team to go break down a barrier, or it's in a mastermind room, or someone on this podcast is like, you know what, screw it, I'm going to go take action today, and they change their lives, dude, that's like... that's more rewarding than that $100 million. Like, I know we got to put some monetary value on it, but like that stuff's more rewarding than any dollar amount that comes through the front door, and seeing people break down their own personal barriers and get into the next level. I think that's beyond cool.
So if people want to find out more about you, I know you've got a podcast. Do you have a website? Like, how can people get connected and stay in touch with you?
Yeah, the best way to find us is we're equitywarehouse.com. You can find us pretty much anywhere, Equity Warehouse, on all the different social sites. We do a lot. I do Instagram's my favorite place to communicate with people if you want to reach out. But we're on all the channels. You'll see a lot of our content. We also host, Jason and I, we host the Real Estate Reserve podcast. We're on all the podcast platforms. And, you know, just like this, we go out there and interview real people that are doing real stuff. We're having Seth on here in a few weeks. And, you know, doing that is fun. So yeah, if you want to find me, I'm pretty easy to find on social. Like I said, Instagram is the best way to reach out and DM, or you can check out some of our case studies on how we co-invest with our investors on deals at equitywarehouse.com. And Seth, I appreciate you having me. This was a fun one. It was like a mini mastermind live because we were going deep and I thoroughly enjoyed it, man.
Yeah, man. Me too. Well, I'll be sure to link up to all that stuff, the websites, the Instagram, all this. This is episode 157. So if you go to retipster.com/157, you'll find the show notes with links to all this stuff. Be sure to check that out. Ian, thanks again for coming out. It's awesome to talk to you again. Hopefully we can talk more in the future. To all those listening out there, if you're listening on your phone, go ahead and text the word free, F-R-E-E, to the number 33777. You can stay up to date on everything going on in RE Tipster world. So thanks again for listening, and we'll talk to you next time. Hey folks, I hope you love what you just heard. Before you go, I want to make sure you're aware of the RE Tipster newsletter. This is something that we spend a lot of time pulling in content and conversations from throughout the RE Tipster community. We want to make sure you're aware of the hottest stuff that's going on right now. Things like active deals from other wholesalers in the community in the RE Tipster deal marketplace, or changes in the industry that affect you and you need to know about. And of course, I'm always sharing the latest software and tools and services that I'm using that I think you should know about. And if you followed RE Tipster for any length of time, you already know there's a whole lot more I could talk about because there's a lot that happens in our community each week. And this is stuff you really don't want to miss. And that's why it's so important for you to be aware of what's going on. All you got to do is take out your phone, maybe even the phone you're listening to right now. Go ahead and text the word free, that's F-R-E-E, to the number 33777. And we'll get you added to the email list so you get this newsletter and you're always aware of the most important things going on in our industry. Thanks again for listening. Again, just text the word free to 33777 and we'll get you squared away. Talk to you next time.